It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska's vast wetlands are habitat for an extraordinary abundance and variety of waterfowl and a paradise for hunters. September 1 is opening day for duck season, and hunters will be in blinds with their dogs and shotguns ready. Duck hunting is a tradition that goes along with this time of year, the clouds, the dampness and cool days, and wood smoke in the air. On today's show, we're exploring those traditions and talking about the allure of duck hunting and the skills required. And I've got two of very avid duck hunters who I know are looking forward to getting out of town and getting out to their duck shacks. Wynn Faulkner is a friend, a cabin neighbor down on Kachemak Bay. I wanted to get him on the show when we were talking about aviation because he's also an avid pilot and a lifetime duck hunter and carrying on the tradition with your family.
You bet. Thanks. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for sharing my stories.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And Tom Rothy is also a very avid duck hunter, retired from Alaska Department of Fish and Game, where he was their waterfowl coordinator for 25 years. And Tom, as a volunteer, is now the policy chair for Alaska Ducks Unlimited. Thanks for being here, Tom.
Sure, it's great. And I'm appreciate a program on outdoors that you have. So
enthused. Great. Well, so September 1 is a very, very special day for duck hunters, and that's when you are allowed to just get out there and start hunting. But I get the impression it's not because necessarily that there's anything so special about that day, except that it is the tradition and that this is a sport that's totally wrapped up in tradition. Is that how it is for you, Tom?
I think so. Every year there's a lot of anticipation and preparation that goes into that first sort of ceremonial opportunity to get duck dinners, and so there's a lot of things that we do with preparing our dogs and everything to just get together with the other hunters out there and enjoy that craziness for the first day.
You're just focused on that, and that's your sort of starting line and getting out there.
Right.
Yeah, and everybody's there. I mean, it's not like everybody wants to be out there on that particular day, right? That's what it's all about.
Well, right? It's more than that also, because the northern birds haven't come through yet, and the local ducks are well-populated. They haven't been shot at. Mm-hmm. So it also happens to be one of the best days of the year to actually hunt.
Yeah.
And then once everyone, once they're all shot at after opening day, they're a lot more scarce.
They figure out they don't want to be shot at.
Right. And the northern birds, it's another month away maybe before they start coming down in big quantities.
So, Wynn, tell me what's happening in your family as opening day approaches. Is there a lot of anticipation and preparation to get out there?
There is. Sure, there is. I'm going out with my brother and his son and my son. And, of course, we've started a week or two ago by getting our shoulders warmed up and our eyes working and following clay pigeons and practicing a little bit on the guns, because that's always a good idea to get a little of that in before you're actually out on the flats. And getting your decoys ready, after the last use last season, they're all mixed up and the cords are all together and the weights and everything. So getting all those things ready to go and getting the airplane prepared and ready. So there's quite a bit. And of course, the anticipation, the camping aspect of it, the hunting, and the annual poker game.
A lot of packing to do. What about the beer? Do you have to stock up on beer?
Oh, there might be a little of that going out there.
Yeah, I imagine so. So you gave us this photo, which is on our website at alaskapublic.org under duck hunting. If you folks scroll down, a couple of young men, a dog, and a bunch of ducks. And it sounds like this is a generational thing in your family.
Oh, yeah. I was, I think I've been hunting probably close to 40 years. I'm 50 this year. And I think my dad started taking me out there when I was a youngster. And it was probably my most anticipated day of the year, at least in the fall. And there wouldn't be any sleep that night before. It would be very difficult to sleep. And we'd be getting up early at 4 or 5 in the morning. And that's carried forward into my life and with my son. And my daughter as well, who's in school. She won't be going with us this time, but sometimes she goes with us. And it's also a tradition with my family and my brother getting together with him and his kids and friends to the extent that we can fit them in our cabin.
Yeah, yeah. And so school day, not school day, this is a day that's worth missing a little school.
Yeah, normally I don't think there ever was a day that I didn't go. You know, the school never made an impact on that for me. I always missed it.
Yeah.
My daughter's not quite as avid, you know, in terms of the hunting aspect as my son is, but he's not in school yet, so it works out for him.
And Tom, you're saying that your hunting partner is your wife, and you have different aspects of this that you do together as a couple.
Right. We're both originally from the Midwest. She's from Iowa, where there's lots and lots of ducks on the edge of the prairies there, and I'm from Wisconsin, wooded country, but I never grew up hunting because something about World War II turned my dad off about guns. Mm-hmm. So I inherited my traditions growing up with other friends who went hunting. And then when I went to college in waterfowl biology, of course, I hooked up with a whole bunch of people who really enjoyed duck hunting. So, our whole thing is my wife is a really good dog trainer. We have retrievers all the time. And so that is something she really enjoys. So we trade off skills. I'm a shooting instructor. Ann does the blinds. I do the decoys. And so as a team, we get along fairly peacefully in getting set up every time.
Uh-huh. So does she shoot too?
Oh, yeah. Yep. And it's her dogs that are really skilled at going out there and collecting our prizes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so where are you headed to and for how long?
I go out to a cabin on Susitna Flats that I have with some partners, and they have a little community on the lake where a lot of hunters show up on opening day, and we know most of the fellows there, so it's a bit of a social event, but it's a very nice community of folks that cooperate on where to go, how to set up, helping each other out, and we all have a good time.
So that's the kind of one time that you hook up with them every year, is that at the beginning of the hunting season?
Yeah, a neighbor comes from New York. He brings white-tailed deer steaks and elk steaks for opening night dinner. So, yeah, it's a real diverse crew.
Now, Wynn was telling me you've got a rather luxurious shack with a cupola and a boardwalk and all this stuff.
Well,
did you build that yourself?
I can't divulge the secrets of the private group. but yeah, it's quite comfortable. It's an old fellow named Bill Sherwood built it originally, and he wanted it comfortable because he spent a lot of time out there and enjoyed bringing many, many groups of young people and friends through to share the traditions.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's the social part in the evening has got to be a big part of it as well.
Yeah, the early part of the season, of course, you can hunt until after 9, and it gets to be a long, tired day if you're out there.
Is that what you would do? Just get up at dawn and just hunt all day long?
Yeah, my wife will tell you I hate getting up in the morning and I hate rain. So I don't know why I'm a duck hunter, but
yeah.
But part of our tradition too is doing kind of gourmet food too. So we do that.
I love, you know, I've talked to so many people on the show about their food that they like to do in remote places. It seems like being out somewhere remote makes you want to cook more than being at home. And wanting to put together like some elaborate dinner that you can then come home and say, well, I made thus and such out of my cabin, or and I could tell you my own stories, but it's not about me. What about you, Wynn? Are you big on food, or are you more like a mountain house freeze-dried guy?
Well, we have pretty much the opposite extreme shack that Tom has. We're on the other end, you know, where it's really not too conducive to sitting around hanging out and enjoying yourself too much. It's pretty much on the lower fringe of just a roof over your head.
It's just a shack.
It's a shack, and it's keeping the rain off your head.
Some of those shacks out on Susitna Flats are just some pilings and just a shack on top of it, and it's just a dry place.
Yeah. And on a lot of them, you know, the tides will come over the floor, you know, the really super high tides of the year. So ours is kind of more in that category. But we do enjoy the night before, and depending on, you know, usually we fry some steaks and have a good hearty meal like that. And, you know, the opening day for us is generally speaking, and for most people, I imagine it's Tom, it's a short day because you're only allowed 8 ducks. And of course, we stop at our limit of 8. And so it's usually a chance to get back to the cabin by noon for your noontime nap. Wow. You know, if you're done by then, and hopefully uh-huh. most of us, generally speaking, are on the lake that I go to, which is closer to the Belug on the Susitna Flats. It's called Seeley Lake after old Doc Seeley. I would say that 90% of the airplanes actually have taken off and left by noontime on opening day. They're done and gone.
Wow.
So yeah, it's
so. Will you stay over the next night, or will you fly home? Because I know you're on your own plane.
Yeah. You know, it depends who I'm with and what their schedule is. But I think on this opening day, I'll be coming back Sunday because we've got some commitments on Monday.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it depends. If you charter,
right,
then it's a little more expensive. We tend to want to go out for three-day weekends and or more.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Cover those, divide those costs for the charter over a larger
right.
denominator. Yeah, I hear you. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about duck hunting, obviously. I'm Charles Wolforth, and the studio with me is Wynn Faulkner, who's a pilot, lifelong duck hunter, getting ready to go out there to the Susitna Flats this weekend. Tom Rothy, who's a retired ADFG waterfowl coordinator and is policy chair for Ducks Alaska Ducks Unlimited. There's so many different aspects of this sport to talk about, but one of the things that fascinates me is getting the ducks to come to you with this whole process of the decoys, the duck calls, you know, this whole thing, a lot of which seems really... to the novice seems kind of strange or silly, you know, that like, oh, you've got this model duck and then that duck is actually going to make a duck come to you and you're going to blow this weird sound. But it sounds like it really is an important part of the sport. Mm-hmm. Wynn?
You bet it's important. You know, I always like going out with a few hunters that aren't into the blind, so they can walk around and chase the ducks up into the air and then they come over to me and my blind with my duck call. I think it's a fun part of the day before opening day where you get to go out and build your blind and put your decoys out and try to figure out the exact right location of each decoy so that you can have the ducks come naturally into them and not be scared away.
And you kind of anchor them?
You anchor them down, yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of the ponds over there aren't too deep.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then learning how to call properly and practicing that. And
so you need to rebuild your blind every year?
Generally speaking, yeah. I'm not, you know, Tom's down there in the rich part of the world, you know, in the fancy cabins and stuff. he might have the permanent blinds down there, but
we just have more logs.
But
the tide comes over where you're at. So
yeah, for the most part, the really high tides take out anything on the flats mm-hmm. of any consequence. And there's even there's blinds that people put out there that are more permanent, but for the most part, they have to be, fixed up and regrassed or whatever they're using for their, you know, for to block, you know, their bodies from the ducks.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of all this deception, of course, is that you want to bring in birds really close so you do a nice, efficient job of shooting them. You don't want to have birds that are too far out and take chances.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing is trying to get into that duck's brain and get its attention. There's a whole series of what I call the arts, actually. It's the decoys are just there to kind of give them a place to home in on. The calling, if you're good, will really let them focus right in on your location. I'm not that good, so my favorite call is just shutting up. if they see you, you know, just don't mess with them. But there's a whole, you know, the whole art of decoy making and collecting and painting is a real interesting aspect to it, and as well as the calling. And
so do you collect decoys? Do you have decoys that are too good to use or that kind of thing?
No, all of my decoys go in the water one way or the other. Uh-huh. I don't want to anything too fancy. But yeah, I have a few old collectors from the East Coast and a few birds that some of my friends in Juneau have made. So yeah, it's fun.
And are they're wooden and hand painted and all that? Because I've seen plastic ones floating around too.
Well, yeah. I mean, duck hunting is a little gear intensive. Where you like to have a dozen, couple dozen, three dozen decoys. So unless you're a craftsman, and I'm not, I can go down to the local store and buy a few.
Do you think those work just as good?
I think the biggest mistake hunters make is, especially people from outside, is they buy big, bright, shiny looking things. Mallards with metallic emerald green heads. And as Wynn can tell you, most of our ducks are pretty brown looking right now. They haven't really come back into their breeding plumage. So anything brown, anything a little bit more dull is probably going to be effective. They need to be fairly realistic, but these are mostly young birds that are easily fooled here. The first few weeks, it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You know, an unusual aspect of decoys that I've found over the years is a swan decoy. Ducks seem to be attracted to swans, and swans are not legal to shoot. So we'd only use a swan decoy because, for some reason, they attract ducks. Every time you see, you know, I fly over the flats a lot, and we'll see a lot of trumpeter swans, more as the year goes on. But right now, there's probably, you know, 50 out there in various spots. You'll always see a few ducks around those swans. So you know, as much as you're not trying to attract a swan with a swan decoy, it's effective, I think, in attracting ducks as well.
It's so interesting to think of the ducks that are checking out your decoys and thinking, well, that one doesn't look like it's in the right state of plumage. I'm not landing there.
Those are called confidence decoys. You'll see every once in a while somebody will have a plastic gull out in their set because it tells the ducks, well, if that gull or that floating goose is pretty calm there, it must be a good spot to go. So they're more likely to come in.
Interesting. So, Wynyette, tell me about your calling. Do you do a lot of calling?
Yeah, do a lot of calling. It seems to not matter quite as much on opening day because the ducks are roaming around and there's lots of local ducks. But the combination of calling, decoys, is, you know, you can turn ducks that are swinging by. You know, if they're a few hundred yards, 300 yards away, and you can, generally speaking, you can turn them. If they're looking for a place to land, if they've got something else on their mind, like, you know, I'm getting out of Dodge, you might not be able to turn them. But it's very, very common to turn ducks, have them come right in to check out your spread. They may not come directly in and set their wings to land, but you can get them to come over you to check it out, and that's all you really need. Uh-huh.
So did you bring, is that a duck call you've got right there?
Oh, yeah, I got a couple calls. I got a goose call here and a duck call.
All right, give us a hoot.
Okay, here's the duck.
Wow, that does sound like a duck.
Doesn't that sound like a duck?
Yeah, it really does.
Of course, you gotta try not to use the call, which is the one which is for, you know, hey, there's a hunter over here. Yeah, get the heck out of Dodge.
Don't use the distress call, right?
The distress call. I'm not sure I know the difference, but
so that just sounded like a standard issue generic duck right there, and I don't know what you were trying to say with that.
Right.
Well, Wynn's right. I mean, the idea is to first of all let them find you out there. Hello, I'm here. You know, and then the more artistic you are, you get to talk duck a little bit better, coax them in closer, but again, it's one of those arts, you have to practice it, and you can't learn it between now and Sunday.
It sounds like duck hunting is something you learn from your dad, you know, or from your buddy. It's not something you like get a book about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah,
I think most people learn at least some of the basics, and I would recommend that to any beginner is to go with someone who kind of knows what they're doing. Helps you find spots and how to hunt them, and then also gives you a sense of how much stuff you need and what you need to learn at least to start giving it a try.
Yeah, so you were talking, Wynn, about the call could divert a duck to closer to you. How close do you want a duck before you would take a shot at it? I'd like to hear both of you talk about that, and how important is shooting skill in this sport? Seems like it'd be pretty big.
Well, I'd say, you know, 30 yards, 20 yards, you know, if you can get them into 20 yards, which you typically can with a blind and ducks in your decoy set out, you can get them into that range. Much closer than that, you're going to have a problem, you know, really, if they get too close because your shot pattern will be too small. And much further than 30 or maybe 40 yards, and you're really not going to hit anything. Most of us that are sitting over blinds have our guns, the barrels are such that they're putting out a pattern, a pretty big pattern there, because you're not trying to shoot as far as you can. You're trying to shoot a short distance. So you have a choke, which is set in the end of your barrel, which helps determine the shots, the spread of the shot. Mm-hmm. And so we design and get the chokes for blind shooting down to, you know, like a 20-yard, you know, 20 to 30-yard type pattern. Mm-hmm. Your shooting skill is depending, it's important, familiar with how to shoot a gun and probably shoot some clays before you get out there. It's important, familiar with how to shoot a gun and probably shoot some clays before you get out there. It's important. It is important. Mm-hmm. When you're shooting out of a blind and you have a good decoy spread, it makes it a lot easier because if the ducks are coming in and setting their wings and flying directly at you, that's a lot easier shot than, say, a duck that's flying by you at 30 yards above your head, just flying over your head. That's a much more difficult
shot. You've got to lead it in that case and really know what the heck you're doing, yeah.
Yeah, so the blind shooting typically is a lot easier, still requires skill. Last year I went with someone, a friend of mine, and he wasn't throwing his gun up properly, and he, at the end of the day, his bicep was all bruised. It is helpful to get out there and shoot a little bit beforehand and get yourself looking down your gun properly and feeling it.
Type of shotgun do you prefer and what size of shot?
Well, I shoot a semi-automatic 12-gauge shotgun, manufactured Benelli, but that's just my preference. Gun I used to shoot for years, I just shot a Remington 870 pump for probably the first 15 years of my life. And then the shot size, that's really varies if you're shooting out of a blind or not, but I'm shooting out of a blind. Most of my shots are going to be close, so I'm using a shot size of about 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. If you're shooting the longer shots, I don't know, Tom, how many years ago was it they changed from
steel
lead shot to steel shot?
Yeah, 1991.
Huh? 1991. Makes a big difference in your takedown ability. Doesn't go as far. It doesn't have as much takedown capacity. So, if you used to shoot a 6 lead, you've got to shoot a 4 steel. And what that means is that's the size and the number of pellets. Mm-hmm. So we used to, with the lead pellets, you used to have more pellets that would reach out further than the steel pellets. Now you have to have a bigger steel pellet for so you have less of them, mm-hmm. and then they don't reach out quite as far. So.
And that was done just because the lead was poisoning the water, and so that was probably a good change to make, even if it made it a bit harder.
Yeah, nationwide, there were probably 1.5-2 million birds dying of lead poisoning, and it was a big legal battle that involved manufacturers and hunters with strong traditions. But about 1986, a lawsuit that tried to prevent lead poisoning of eagles kind of settled the deal. And most hunters have been shooting steel now for a long time. And as Wynn said, you use a little bigger pellet, 4s or 3s, than if you were using a lead load. But this stuff works good, and the main thing is practice. This is the kind of thing where 2-3 weeks ago we should all have been out on the clay target range tuning up.
That's where I was.
I think the bane of waterfowl hunters is have some of our fellows out there that are being competitive and trying to scrape stuff off the bottom of the clouds and they're just not that good a shooter most of the time. So we don't want people to be practicing and wounding birds. We want them to be very efficient and bring them in close and learn what works for your gun and shotgun.
And do you tell us about what you use in terms of a gun?
I've been involved in hunter education and that conversion to non-toxic shot for a long time. So I got a lot of training in ballistics. And number 3 shot is probably the best overall duck load for our size ducks, which are medium size for the most part. Mm-hmm. Best goose load is starting at number 1s if you're over decoys or they're fairly close, or going to a size BB. I know this is foreign terminology for a lot of people.
For those who know nothing about it, it's not helpful, but
let's put it
this
way. For those
who do know, it's useful information.
The goose size shot's probably up there in the neighborhood of like a 20 caliber ball or something close to that. Mm-hmm. You need bigger shot for bigger birds, but pretty much over decoys, anything from small sixes to fours to threes works perfectly good if you know how to handle the gun.
Well, this is a really interesting topic. We have another half hour to go in the second half of the show. Lots more to talk about duck hunting, conservation, what Ducks Unlimited does, and just opening day, which is coming up as Outdoor Explorer continues. But now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. On Friday, August 30th at 6:30 p.m., there will be a Fair Day 5K race at Palmer High School. The Valley Women's Running Team is hosting this 5K race starting at Palmer High and continuing on a paved loop course with some hills. You can sign up on race day from 4 to 6 p.m. or find the online registration link on the Facebook page for Valley Women's Running Team. Also in Palmer this Saturday from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., the National Outdoor Leadership School, also known as Knowles Alaska, will have its fall gear sale. There will be a large selection of used gear for sale. The Knowles Alaska headquarters are located at 5805 Farm Loop Road in Palmer. On Thursday, September 5th at 6 p.m., Alaska Huts Association will be giving a multimedia presentation at REI Anchorage on the recently opened Manitoba Cabin, a walk-in ski-in hut site with a fully equipped hut and two yurts. See photos, videos, check hut availability for fall and winter, and see how easy it can be to get out overnight in snow season. To reserve your spot for this free event, go to the REI Anchorage website. Finally, the Cordova Fungus Festival. Cordova Fungus Festival, a little bit of a tongue twister, is coming up on September 6th, 7th, and 8th. To tell us more about it, we have Aaron Cooper with us. Hi, Aaron.
Hi there.
So I understand that we're catching you on the ferry crossing Prince William Sound right now.
Well, I'm actually stuck in Whittier. They can't lower the ramp, so I'm here on the ferry as well.
Oh, no. So tell us about the Fungus Festival. It seems like we're always talking to Cordova people about some fun event you guys are doing. What's this one all about?
Well, the Fungus Festival started with Cordovans really do love harvesting, and we love wild food. And I think the thing is what we wanted to do is learn more about the natural world around us. And so we started bringing speakers in to talk about fungus and how to harvest and how to identify. And it's really grown into a festival where we learn how to dye wool with mushrooms, learn how to ID mushrooms, mushroom-related crafts, and then we have a mushroom-related feast.
I'm sorry, feast. Okay, so
do you
eat mushrooms that you're gathering right there in Cordova?
We do. This year, it's a wild harvest feast, and it's going to support the Copper River Watershed Project as a fundraiser for them. So it's we're joining not only the Fungus Festival, a bunch of different groups. I'm with the Forest Service. I'm a biologist with the Forest Service, and it's the Chamber of Commerce, the Native Village of Eak, so a lot of other organizations gather together and to put this event on.
Huh. Interesting. You know, it seems like we had a dry summer, and I kind of forgot what a mushroom looked like. And then the last three or four weeks, they're everywhere. Everywhere you turn around, there's mushrooms. Is it a good harvest down there? And is fall mushroom harvest time anyway?
Yeah, it is. In fact, you know, we're having a great bloom of mushrooms, so to speak, in Cordova right now. And I know friends in Girdwood, their Girdwood Fungus Fair is actually this weekend for those people who don't want to venture too far from home.
Right.
And that, they're saying that, you know, the mushrooms are coming out on the Kenai pretty strong. And then in Girdwood, just starting.
So I would be a little bit nervous about harvesting mushrooms because I would be afraid of poisoning myself. Are you going to have guided picking or guided walks at the festival?
Right. There's outings where you can actually go with a mushroom expert, and they'll tell you how to identify mushrooms. And we also have ID tables. So in Cordova, at our Fungus Festival, we have identification tables as well as mushroom experts on hand. So you can go out. We have a schedule at the Cordova Chamber of Commerce website that you can check out. And everybody meets at the Forest Service, and you go you meet there, and then we get in cars, and we go out the road, and you go with a variety of different experts, and you can go at different levels. So there's a foray for beginners, and then an afternoon outing to learn about edible mushrooms, and then we also have a foray for folks who want to learn a little more intermediate mushroom identification. So that's the whole idea, is to get people out and about and learning, you know, what's in their backyard.
Yeah, that sounds really fun. And I've said this before, but Cordova is about the funnest place for an outdoor person to go anywhere, because there's so many trails, there's so many great places to go canoeing, there's amazing boating and sea kayaking on Prince William Sound. I mean, it's a fantastic place to go for short vacation, even if you're not focused on an event, but this fungus festival adds to it all. And so is it the best way to get down there on the ferry, assuming the ramp is operational?
Yeah, the ferry is a great way to go, because you can put your car on the ferry and then you have a little mobility. You can also fly into Cordova. There's daily flights, so you can rent a car in Cordova. Right now it is silver salmon season in Cordova. So there's a lot of people who actually come for both events. They come to fish for silvers and they come to harvest mushrooms.
I bet there's some duck hunting going on out there too on the Copper River Delta.
There will be.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Aaron. I hope they let you off the ferry eventually.
Oh, eventually. It's a great day to be inside.
All right. So that was Aaron Cooper. She is with the Cordova Fungus Festival. She's with the U.S. Forest Service. Thanks a lot for being with us, and good luck. And we'll have a link to the 2013 Cordova Fungus Festival, as well as links to all the other events we've mentioned on today's calendar on the Outdoor Explorer calendar at alaskapublic.org. You know, you can get right to our own webpage at alaskapublic.org/outdoorexplorer. And our Facebook page is a great place to hook up with the show as well. Comments come in. We've got pictures and videos, stuff about today's topic. And we welcome you to take a look at that. Just type Outdoor Explorer into your Facebook. All right. Stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll continue to talk about duck hunting when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and fall is definitely in the air. In the spirit of our show, we're always enthusiastic about the coming of the seasons. We're talking about duck hunting. Opening day is coming up September 1, and we've got a couple of avid duck hunters in the studio who are going to be out there with their dogs, their decoys, their shotguns, and their family members to participate. Wynn Faulkner is with me. He's a lifelong duck hunter and outdoors person and aviator. Tom Rothy is also a hunter, also an Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist who is retired and also volunteers with Alaska Ducks Unlimited. Tom, the status of ducks and other waterfowl in Alaska is pretty good, right? I mean, it's there are some species that have issues, eiders and so forth, but for the most part, ducks are really abundant here. Is that true?
Yeah, I think in general, everything's in really good shape right now. We had some low populations of geese in western Alaska in the mid-80s. We had the great North American drought in the late 80s. But everything's come back really well. So, for example, we have more white-fronted geese in Alaska now than we've had for a long, long time. So there's great opportunities there. Lots of ducks. We are never short of ducks. We have so many wetlands up here that people worry about when the forecast comes out, there's so many millions of ducks. Well, we always have plenty of them.
Right.
The only thing I need to be careful about is nationally, there's some concern about canvasbacks. So there's a reduced limit on canvasbacks, but they're fairly rare in most parts of Alaska. The Bering Sea area, you have Steller's eiders and Spectacled eiders, which are closed because of population problems there. And emperor geese are still closed in the Alaska Peninsula. But
those that's nothing a hunter around here would worry about,
or
Kodiak.
No, Cook Inlet, it's pretty much fair game for about anything that comes through.
Yeah, so, and that, I suppose, is because we've got an incredible amount of wetlands here, and it's all in its natural state. And so with Ducks Unlimited, it seems like you wouldn't have too much of a challenge in conserving duck populations in Alaska because there's so much habitat available. What are the focuses that you work on at Ducks Unlimited?
Well, DU as a national organization is probably the largest wetlands and waterfowl conservation group out there with 600,000 members. It's all people dedicated to primarily preserving habitat so that we have ducks in perpetuity. Alaska has about 5,000 members, maybe more, and people get together usually in communities all over to raise funds that eventually get dedicated to some sort of wetlands conservation work. In Alaska, we do have two-thirds of Alaska may be considered reasonable waterfowl habitat, so the main focus up here is kind of keeping what we have in good condition. Mm-hmm. It's not so much restoring and maintaining, because we do have so many great wild areas for birds.
And where are ducks going in the wintertime? They must need habitat somewhere else, right?
Yeah, I think Ducks Unlimited and other conservation groups have spent a lot of time working toward preserving places like Central California, where the major wintering grounds are, hardwood forests in the mid-continent, Gulf Coast. If we don't save those kinds of habitats, those birds that winter there are going to, suffer some problems. So our emphasis is to be generous and make sure those wintering areas are protected. Alaska is kind of the apex where we have birds that winter actually going to Japan, Korea, the other side of the Bering Sea. We have lots of birds that go down the Pacific coast between the Rockies and the coast. Probably 60% go there. But also birds that go down the central flyway to Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. And we even have a bunch of birds that cut straight across the continent and go to Chesapeake Bay, Pamlico Sound, North Carolina. So we really feed birds to the entire North American area.
They come from everywhere to be here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you were talking about these local ducks that are the ones that you will be hunting on the opening day, so those are ducks that are summering right here in Cook Inlet, and they'll be taken off, assuming you don't shoot them, they'll be taken off and wintering somewhere else. And then there's another group of ducks that will come through later that is sort of a different population.
Yeah. Exactly. The northern birds, once it starts freezing up north, will start making their way down and go on their migration route. And they stop here for some period of time, usually, depending on the weather patterns and how much water we have that's open.
Mm-hmm. And so how long will you keep going out there? Do you get tired of hunting at some point, or do you keep going as long as there's any ducks? Are you capable? You don't get tired of flying. I know that.
Right. Usually, opening day is the best day to shoot, and it's kind of the tradition day. And then after that, depending, like I was saying, on my lake, Seeley Lake, there might be 15 to 20 airplanes on opening morning.
Wow.
And they all but two planes will leave by noontime on opening day morning.
Hmm.
So that means they've got all their ducks, and they're gone, and they're going back to town. It's a real quick hunt over there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a few that stay around. And then that's going to be the best time to shoot. And then a lot of the local population in that area gets shot up just because there's so many people in my area.
Mm-hmm.
And the hunting really drops off. But it, you know, it's somewhat dependent on the population. You know, last year we had a really good population. This year I flew in the flats the last couple days at low altitude, and it didn't seem nearly as many as last year. You know, I'm hoping it'll be good, and it's just a quick flight over, you know, so I can't say exactly, but it looks to me like there were not as many this year as I've seen in the past. And the ones I did see this year were, there were some real large flocks, which is a little unusual this time of year.
So will you go back out there in October when the northern birds come through, but it's a little bit more of a solitary experience?
Yeah, and that depends on how if the lakes are open. If they're frozen or not.
How cold the winter's been, yeah.
Yeah, and it's going to depend where you're going. If you're going to a lake, then it's got to be open and free of ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually about the 10th or 15th, the water gets real hard. Of October. No airplane to travel with.
Depends on what kind of year it is, right?
Well, I've broken my decoys out of ice on September 10th. So, it really depends on the weather. And then, of course, you can still hunt it, but you have to move onto wheels and hunt somewhere where you're not landing on water.
And do you do that? Or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, lucky enough to be able to do both. But
I know you're in the air all the time. You really fly a lot.
Oh, you know, a fair amount. I mean, I'm not, commercial pilot flying 8 hours a day kind of thing, but I do a lot of hunting and fishing.
Mm-hmm. So the sounds like the prime species you're going for is mallards. Is that just because of what kind of eating they are and how big they are, or what are you looking for? What's your best duck that you want to?
The mallard is the premium duck for us. Mm-hmm. It's the largest duck. It's probably the best eating, it's the hardiest duck. It's the probably the most difficult to knock out of the air just because of the size.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the number one duck. And then we have pintails, which are almost as big as mallards, not quite, have a real long neck on them. And smaller ducks would be widgeons, which are real plentiful over in the flats, who sit in a flat area. Teal, which is the smallest duck, they almost look like a baby duck, but they're actually full-sized ducks, they're just very small. And then to a lesser extent, we have things like gadwalls and, the canvas backs, we just don't see many of those ducks.
So do you sort of pick your shots that you want to use your eight on all on mallards, or how does that work?
You know, it depends what kind of duck population you have and how excited you are. But I know a lot of people that only shoot at the big ducks and don't bother with the big ducks. Typically don't fly in the big flocks, and the big flocky type ducks are more like the widgeon and the teal.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people will pick their shots and wait until the big ducks come in. If you want to do that, you know, it's going to take you longer because there just may not be as many of those flying by.
Yeah. I'm interested in the role of the dogs and how you train the dogs to retrieve the ducks. And it sounds like that's a big part of it for you, Tom, or for you and your wife.
Yeah, it is. Like I said, my wife Ann is really the dog person in the family, and she has done some breeding of Labradors, and we're now on to Chesapeakes, and I have a Drahtar, which is a German wire hair pointer. But for us, that's part of the enjoyment, to have the dog trained well enough to just watch that use of the eyes and the nose to just go out there and save us a long trudge. Through the water. And then there are times where we knock birds down, they're not dead, and they may run off or swim off, and then the dog saves your honor. If you're lucky, they get right onto it. But it takes a lot of training.
So they could swim and catch an injured duck and dispatch it, or bring it back to you to dispatch?
They learn that. They learn how to deal with birds that are still alive. Our Chesapeake, for example, knows how to stop and circle and wait for the duck to come back up. Huh. And she'll work it and work it, and she's very successful at it.
Wow. How do you train that?
Well, it starts with getting a reasonably good dog that has that skill bred into it. There's lots of retrieving dogs out there to choose from if you have a good breeder. But the training is all the way from the very beginning, teaching the retrievers to use their eyes, because that's the key tool where they've got to watch birds go down, pinpoint them, And then you work through a series of more and more obstacles to get them to push on, no matter what, to go straight to where those birds came down, and you get that all solidified. And then at some point, you will teach things like whistle training, where you hit a whistle and the dog stops and looks for direction. And really, the ultimate in a hunting dog, we've had two that we've taken to the top limit, is you can give it a left-hand signal, a right-hand signal, a back signal, a come-in signal, and it's just like driving a little remote control dog out there. It's just spectacular when you've worked that hard for a year or two to get that in them.
Wow, that sounds like a tremendous amount of investment of time and connection with that dog to get it to
is.
That level.
It's got to be something your family likes. Likes to live with big, rambunctious dogs, and somebody's going to go out every day and do some exercise with it.
Uh-huh.
Do
you work with dogs too, Wynn?
Yeah, I've got a black Labrador retriever, and what I find most interesting is once, you know, they'll go in circles when they don't know exactly where the duck's down, and once they catch that scent, it's like a light bulb goes off in their head, and they just pinpoint, they go straight to the duck. And
it's bred into them.
Oh, well, yeah, and it's part of their... You know, if they've got a good nose on them, mm-hmm. and mine does, it's really just phenomenal. And like Tom's saying, that's really, for me now, when I miss a duck, it's not, you know, I feel bad for my dog. It's not so much that I care that I don't have, a little more duck in my pouch for me to eat. I feel really bad that my dog didn't get a retrieve, because she gets so much enjoyment and excitement out of that. And it is just absolutely one of the best things.
Well, that sounds like a great part of the sport, is the sharing aspect with your kids, with your parent, and then also with the animal, that you're all sort of in this on as a teamwork.
Absolutely, and it's their greatest day of the year, for sure. It's any day of the year, I can make a duck sound with my mouth, and she'll start looking around and start shivering.
Great. Yeah, the dog gets to do what he was bred for. Our little terrier, I guess, is bred to catch rats and hasn't gotten to do that. But your dog gets to actually carry on his purpose for being alive.
Hopefully yours doesn't get too much action.
We haven't seen her, though. She spends a lot of time in the woodpile behind the cabin, so who knows. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today, duck hunting. You were just hearing from Wynn Faulkner, who is a duck hunter, aviator, and an outdoorsman. Tom Rothy is policy chair for Alaska Ducks Unlimited, a retired waterfowl coordinator for Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and also an avid hunter. It strikes me, like most of our, I guess some of our outdoor activities, dip netting, moose hunting, make sense economically. You go out and you get food. Duck hunting is pretty far off the end of that spectrum, right? All the work of training the dogs and getting out there and everything else. But you do come back with some fabulous food. I mean, duck is a really, really delicious. What does it take, and jump in whoever wants to take it first, to get from that game bag to the table? I mean, there's a bit of work in preparing the duck and, you know, recipes and everything else. And how do you like to eat your duck?
I think there's definitely a division in the world between people who either like duck or don't like duck. But I think part mm-hmm. of it is they haven't had well-prepared duck.
So, that's a fact, yeah.
So we can try to change that. The European traditions say that you shoot a duck and you hang it for a while to get it tenderized, kind of like good steak has mm-hmm. aged a little bit. You probably want to clean them out fairly soon because they have been shot up a bit. In the field, you can leave the feathers on until you get... home, and then there's several treatments. You can pluck, which entertains you for hours and hours. we sit around the living room with a sheet, you know, and pluck ducks and watch TV or something. You eventually want to get all the feathers off. Waxing is a good time-tested method. You melt wax in a bucket of water, and you dip the bird. All the feathers come peeling off, and you have something that looks like a nice grocery store chicken, actually. It's a real nice way to go. And then after that, it's a matter of taste. Some people like roasted duck in the oven, We occasionally do grilled or quick fried in a pan, mm-hmm. to a piece of rare duck breast in a pan with a little bit of spices. It's just like a good piece of steak. But then you can go all the way down to the gumbo for mm-hmm. birds that aren't quite as pretty, and do all sorts of things with them.
Does the meat get gamier after being frozen for a while, or does it? I mean, do you want to eat it fresh for the best possible quality?
I think the key is, first of all, you need to be careful about the ducks. For example, widgeon are vegetation eaters, and if you puncture the entrails of widgeon, you're going to have a bird that's going to get gamey real fast, so you can clean those out. If you clean them fairly promptly and wash them out well, they really aren't all that gamey. I think a lot of people are finding out now that you can take birds and you wrap them in saran wrap, vac pack them, and that's the best way I've found to keep a bird for even a couple of years.
Oh, really? Would you cut it? You'd cut it up first, though.
No, we'd like to keep our bird skin on and whole, so we have the options later on.
All right. So when I come back from fishing with my family, I've noticed that there's this amazing disappearing thing that happens. That like everybody's together having fun, and then it's time to clean the fish, and suddenly I'm all by myself. I don't know how that happens. Is it sort of the same thing with taking care of your ducks after you come back from hunting, or are you the one who's disappearing and your wife has to do it?
No. My wife, you know, she's not participating in the hunt per se, and that's all our chore. Uh-huh. We typically do our plucking out in the field just because there's so many feathers, and it's you can just let them go into the flats. You know,
are the feathers ever good for anything? I mean, they're not good for anything, right?
Well, I mean, I suppose they could be good for something, but when you have a lot of ducks, and there's three or four people shooting, and everyone's got their limit.
That's a lot of ducks.
There's a lot of feathers, and what I've found is mostly that the mallards are they're worth taking whole. You know, you can pluck the whole thing because they've got good leg meat. But most of the other ducks, there's so little meat other than what's on the breast, is that sometimes we'll just take the breast meat right off and not take the rest of the bird, because there's really nothing other than the legs. And, you know, the first joint in the legs would be the only meat, you know, at all. Mm-hmm. I've taken mallards, though, that are big and plump and full and cook those up, and they're incredible, taking the whole bird. But for the most part, the smaller ducks, the widgeons and teal, you know, there's really very little meat on them. So when you bring back eight birds, all of the breast meat that you might get might fit into a small size baggie.
Yeah, they're almost like a squab or a little game Cornish game hen or something, yeah.
Right.
About two-thirds of the ducks that we're all going to shoot in September are probably young birds that were born this year, so they don't have a lot of fat on them. Mm-hmm. The later you go, the more fat that shows up on them. And those are when you get the prime roasters.
Those are tastier?
The beauties, yeah, that you can put in the oven. And the other thing is, I think you mentioned about selection. One thing we do is we accumulate greenwing teal. There is nothing better than the recipe we use for greenwing teal on the grill. And so we have a little grill section in the freezer and a little bit of everything else too.
Mm-hmm. So if you've got two or three dozen ducks, you're eating duck quite a bit. And does the family sort of say, "Oh God, not duck again," or are they still popular after you're done with them?
I think my wife and my daughter might think that.
Yeah.
But we usually we like to have a nice fresh meal, you know, right after opening day.
Uh-huh.
And we like to cook ours in a hearty hunter gravy.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of pan fry them and include the gravy and then eat it over rice or something like that, and they're usually pretty good, and everyone usually likes them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've noticed that kids who grew up in Alaska eating game sometimes are the ones who hate game the most. Right? It's the recent converts to being Alaska sometimes will say, "Wow, this is great. You know, I love it." But I think one of the things that happens is that just like any food, if fish and game is not prepared well, it's just not that palatable or great, just like any food. You know, if you take a most beautiful king salmon and you cook it for twice as long as you should be cooking it, it's just dry and not very tasty. But if you cook it just right, it's great. And I'm sure that, I mean, I've had wonderful duck. And we haven't mentioned duck soup. Yeah, duck soup?
Oh, yeah. That's good. I tend to, we pan fry the breast. That's a special little treat. I keep the carcasses, and I actually make duck stock with vegetables, boil that down, so that then I'll have a few quarts of stock that I can use to make a gumbo or a soup later on. And duck soup is really good to get the last the last bits of the flavor out, especially if you've been to a village, for example, in Western Alaska. There's lots of stuff in the soup pot.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, in the north,
it's terrific.
Yeah, or on the North Slope, people will. The duck soup is sort of what they're into, and there'd be a huge pot in the middle of the table, and people are dipping out of it. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. It's a food that is touches a lot of different cultures, in different ways. So the regulatory agency for waterfowl is not Alaska Department of Fish and Game. It's the federal government, and how does that work, and how do you find out the regulations and what you need to know? Just in the last minute or two we have here.
Well, it's a cooperative effort. Actually, historically, since the late 40s, the states have organized into flyway councils to represent the state's interests. They're migratory birds, so the United States Fish and Wildlife Service has primary authority over managing hunting and waterfowl populations. So, essentially, the federal government works with the states to agree on a set of outside boundaries, shall we say, for bag limits and seasons. And then in Alaska here, once the feds issue their guidelines, the Alaska Board of Game then can adopt specific bag limits, season dates, other things locally.
Yeah. So it's a cooperative effort. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. You wanted to mention about the opportunity for young people to learn about shooting, and that's obviously gun safety and everything else is super important when you're bringing up kids.
You bet. I just wanted to mention the youth shotgun league down at Rabbit Creek. I'm not connected with that anymore, but that's where my son learned to shoot sporting clays, and they have a weekly program down there where they have loaner shotguns. And it's a really great way for kids to learn how to shoot. Even if the parents don't know how to shoot, you shoot once a week with an instructor. You shoot for score. You shoot instructed, 25 for score, and 25 with an instructor, and then 25 for score. And it goes on for, I think, a 10-week program in the fall and in the spring. Great way. You don't have to have a gun even. You don't have to have shells. You just have to, join the program as a little money up front, to be part of it. But
great.
It's a great
way. Well, we're
going to
do a show just on shooting coming up in a few weeks here now, so we'll make sure to mention that. Thank you so much for being with us, Wynn Faulkner.
You bet.
And Tom Rothy.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And Aaron Cooper was with us earlier talking about the Cordova Fungus Festival. Coming up next week, we're going to be talking about recreational gold mining. You might not think of gold mining as being recreational, but there's a lot of people who do it as a hobby, not necessarily to get rich, but because they want to be outdoors and want to just go on that treasure hunt. So we're going to be talking to somebody from the Crow Creek Mine and some other guests. Be with us, and have you ever thought about gold mining, and what would you like to know? Join us on Facebook and let us know your questions. So thanks very much. Be with us. We'll be with you next week. I'm Charles Wolforth. That's it for Outdoor Explorer. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.